When I started the startup, I was very sure of one thing, that even if this doesn't work, the worst that can happen is that I'm going to be transformed completely. That's the worst case scenario, which is a scenario that you should always pick. And I had no qualms at all about leaving the job, right? So discovery CEO, very comfortable, very settled, great job, very high paying. The fact was that I looked at it and I said, 2 years more of doing the discovery CEO versus 2 years of trying to build a tech company without knowing tech at all, I'm going to transform in that act of building a tech company, right? And I think that would be the worst thing that can happen out of this whole thing. So I was like, okay, that's a no-brainer. In a choice. But I think that feeling that you're going to get transformed by this act of creation, even if it doesn't achieve conventional success, I would say entrepreneurs have that feeling.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer.
And I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer. Andrew and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we both had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know but want to know more about, how they got their start, how they make it work, and what keeps them going.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee, or in my case, hot chocolate.
On today's show, we're talking to P&G alumni leader Karan Bajaj, founder and CEO of White Hat Jr. It was a great conversation about creating something and the perseverance to do so. Here's a quick bio. Karan Bajaj is the CEO and founder of White Hat Jr., a leading edtech and coding platform for kids, which he founded 2 years ago and was sold to Baijus for $300 million after just 18 months. Prior to that, Karan was the CEO of Discovery Networks in South Asia, where he helped launch and oversee popular channels in India like the Discovery Channel, TLC, Animal Planet, and Discovery Kids. Karan was a senior marketing director over Kraft's $3 billion global gum business, a management consultant for the Boston Consulting Group, and of course, he got his start at P&G, where he spent 6 years on Ariel across Southeast Asia and Herbal Essences in the U.S., where we actually first met. Karan's been awarded one of Ad Age's 40 Under 40. He's hiked almost every tough mountain from Kilimanjaro to Denali. He's a yoga teacher and also a best-selling fiction author of books like Keep Off the Grass, Johnny Goes Down, and The Yoga of Max's Discontent. On top of that, Karan's a husband and a father of two. Now, I've known Karan since the beginning of my career, and over the years, we continue to run into each other at different stages of work and life, as so many of us do. And we always have a great conversation. But Karan has always surprised me with the different ventures and adventures that he's pursued, be it a year off to write a novel, travel the world, or learn yoga, and then jumping back into a very senior business position and driving outstanding results. But some of his impermanence and maybe impatience, which is not the norm for so many people you might hear about on this podcast, was rooted not just in Karan's childhood upbringing as the son of an Indian Army officer, but even in his early career at P&G, where he bounced around assignments successfully around the world, learning and growing, but also spending a lot of time by himself outside of the office, thinking, dreaming, and creating. On the surface, you might read Karan's resume and think he's just another successful business entrepreneur. But what I've come to realize from afar, following his career, reading his novels, and even in this podcast conversation, is that Karan is a creator. For him, it's not about the destination, but the journey and the act of creation from which he learns and transforms himself. The doing and the energy and the effort of making something excellent is just as important as the ultimate output and outcome. Every book Karan writes or every business that he builds is an exploration of questions that he wants to answer for himself. Honestly, it makes me realize something about myself. This past year, creating this podcast, as well as my other podcasts on race and gender and some of my other creative ventures and pursuits, has me asking these same questions of myself, but through conversations with others, is the act of creation. So I think you're going to find this conversation very different from many of the past ones that you've heard on this podcast, but there are definitely some interesting approaches and learnings that are worth hearing and thinking about for yourself and your own take on work and life. So let's dive right in. We hope you'll enjoy our conversation with my old friend and fellow P&G alum, Karan Bajaj. Karan, welcome to the pod. It's really great to have you here.
My pleasure, Raman. It's been a long time and I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks. So Karan, many know your professional story. You're the CEO and founder of White Hat Junior, a leading edtech and coding platform for kids that you founded 2 years ago, which was recently sold to Baidu's for $300 million. Prior to that, you were the CEO of Discovery Networks in South Asia, overseeing popular channels like the Discovery Channel, TLC, Animal Planet, Discovery Kids. You were a senior marketing director over Kraft's $3 billion global gum business, a management consultant for the Boston Consulting Group, and of course, you got your start at Procter & Gamble, where you spent nearly 6 years on Ariel across Southeast Asia and Herbal Essences in the US, where we first met. You were awarded one of Ad Age's 40 Under 40. You've hiked every tough mountain from Kilimanjaro to Denali. You're a yoga teacher, and you're a best-selling fiction author of books like Keep Off the Grass, Johnny Gone Down, and The Yoga of Max's Discontent, which I've read all of them. On top of that, you're a husband and a father of two. And so beyond asking how have you found the time, there is so much in there I'd like to ask about. But I guess my first question, Karan, is who were you before the beginning of your career journey? Can you tell us a story from your youth?
Yes, absolutely. I think I would say in some ways, the turning point for me was not as much the youth, because with everybody who grew up in India in that generation, which was the 1990s, we all had a very predictable path, right? We all worked hard to get into engineering college, went to business school, tried to find a job after that. So we were pretty much on a reasonably predictable path. So I would say go ahead.
I want to ask about before that, though, because something I know about you is you didn't follow the standard path of an Indian kid because your parents were in the army or your dad was in the army.
Correct. So I would say the most formative memory of my childhood is the fact that given my dad was in the army, we kept moving around a lot. So every couple of years, I moved to a new school. I think probably changed about 15 schools or so in the 12 years that I did my schooling. And I think the enduring aspect of that is that I was very comfortable with a movement and kind of rebuilding life again and again. So, and I think that was the pro. I was very comfortable with that. I would say the negative that came out of that was that I was very restless. I think every couple of years I do look for a change in either location or like a profession. So I think that restlessness came from the very early formative years of being an army kid in India.
Back then, what did you want to be when you grew up?
We were so devoid of imagination at that point of time because India pre-liberalization was very kind of, we all just wanted to kind of get a job, right? Because it was hard to find a job in India. So we were all geared towards finding a job. And for that, the path was engineering college, and we like very mindlessly just wanted to do that, right? So my enduring memory of that point was that I was just trying to figure out how to study for college, engineering college entrance, which is very tough in India when my dad kept moving and I kept shifting school. So, but yeah, that was the only kind of real dream was just to get a job.
You sound like my dad, Karan. Come on, I know that.
We were the same generation, maybe.
No, man. You're not that old. We're the same age. But were there any lessons or stories that you got from your parents and your family growing up, bouncing around India in those years?
I would say the only real story is that the Indian Army is an incredibly diverse place, right? Which it's hard to explain, but in a country like India, where the north is so different from the south, the east, the west, where the dialects and the languages are so different from each other, and they're almost countries within India, right? The Indian Army is a true melting pot. So what happened was that very early on, the idea that I would live outside India and I would travel around to multiple countries and I would feel at home everywhere was just very intuitive. You didn't have to think about it. It's only when I came to the US and I was in Cincinnati and I realized that, you know, that was just like a huge positive that I grew up with, right? The fact that people all over the world are going to be more similar than different. I never just had any question about that, right? It was very inherent in my thinking that just that like the world would be more similar than different, right? And I think as a result of that, I just right from the onset was very comfortable when any kind of move happened, right, in my career, because I never had any doubt at all that I would adjust to new cultures easily. Yeah.
So if we fast forward to today, how are you similar to that younger version of yourself? Or how would you say you're different?
Some parts of it very similar. I would say the part of it which always believed that the world is more similar than different led me to kind of choices where I kept, after I graduated from college, I moved to Philippines, then Singapore, then the US, then you know, left my job multiple times to travel around the world. 2-3 times I've left my job to travel around the world. So all of that came from kind of a true belief that I would be welcome anywhere in the world in some form, right? Thanks to the army background. I would say the other part of it was the comfort with starting over again and again. In school, it was a little bit stressful. We didn't even realize because we were all the army kids were pretty much the same. But in school, you kept moving. You had to keep changing. You were always the outsider when you moved to a school in a new city. And when you were an outsider, you don't try to kind of fit in. You create a bit of an independent path for yourself where you kind of fit in by doing your own thing. So I think what happened after that is that when I took on my career, I would say some of the moves that I made where I left Procter & Gamble to just backpack around the world for 1 year, right, in 2008. Then I came back to my job. Then I left 1 year to just learn yoga very deeply. So I was very comfortable with this idea that I'll leave and I'll become a beginner again somewhere and I'll find my place again in that world. So I think that part of me is still pretty much the same, right, which is when I was a Discovery CEO, I would say some other people at age 40 to start a startup, which seems like a very young man's thing, would have been a more intimidating exercise. For me, it felt like I was comfortable with this idea once again that I would be a 21-year-old beginner, almost starting to build a tech company without any knowledge of tech. So I think that feeling of being a beginner again and again is still very prevalent. I think it's just been a very integral part of my life. I don't mind feeling.
On the flip side of that, what's changed? How are you different from that young man who is happy to start over and hit the reset button every few years?
The biggest change has been that, and I wish that would have happened in my childhood. I think the true, I would say, transition point in my life was the act of building my first thing myself, which was writing my first novel. And I think that happened for me at age 29, actually immediately after Procter & Gamble, when I took a year off to travel. Around that time, I was like, oh, these are very interesting experiences. I should write a book. And I actually started writing a book. So then the first novel came, and because the first
novel... That one's Keep Off the Grass.
Right? That's Keep Off the Grass, yeah. 2008, yeah, right. Keep Off the Grass came. And I would say the first act of creation really transformed me, because the act of building something, trying to sell it, the reaction of people, the rejections that you face, the act of pouring everything that you've learned into life into one act of creation, because the first novel, you put all of everything that you've learned in your life into that novel or your book. And then kind of feeling that emptiness in the well and rebuilding new experiences again so that you can create again. I think that was very formative. And I wish that I had experienced that act of building and creating something, right? It could have been a minor thing, maybe a play that I would have written, etc., a little bit earlier in my life, because I think that is the true moment of change or transformation.
And I don't want to spend too much time on your books, but as someone who's read them, and you know, yeah, I read a lot of books by executives, but I chose your books because, one, we became friends years ago and had really kind of deep and silly conversations.
Right.
But I want to make it clear for the audience, your books are not business books. They are not,
accounts
of your business triumphs. They are fictional works, but almost all of them, are the protagonist mirrors you at almost that phase in your life, leaving school in India, walking off the path. And again, I'm oversimplifying it, but I guess the question is, not just where did the creative impulse come from, but why do you think the characters, are you willing to reflect these characters that are clearly reflections of you, I think? When I read these books, I'm like, oh, it's almost like I'm reading about my friend Karan. He just has a very different name.
Yes, yeah. So I think I would say most acts of creation are very autobiographical in nature. Even a startup, for example, I would say is actually not very different from a novel in that sense, right? That you're truly trying to express yourself in that creation. So in that sense, I would say almost most acts of creation are very autobiographical. And that happened to my novels as well. The framework of a novel is basically, there should be something very deeply meaningful that you want to talk about in the world. And it should be wrapped in a very entertaining kind of package, right? So the entertainment was really coming from my own travels and stuff. So I like that was the wrapper. And in the meaning, I think the act of creation really helps you answer questions for yourself in a way. So I think the novel as a device is really, I was posing questions to myself. In Keep Off the Grass, for example, the protagonist leaves business school and travels. And in the next one, it was a very Forrest Gump story where the protagonist lives in multiple countries. And in all of them, I was trying to answer a question for myself, right? In the first one, I was trying to answer the question of what happens when you break conventional path? And is there a learning or an insight that you get, which is richer than being on that path? And I think I answered my questions through my books, if you will. So that's why they are so searching. And
it was almost like self-consumer research.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. So in the act of writing, I was trying to articulate some meaning for myself. And I think that's why they did reasonably well in India also, because we were a generation that was changing. As you rightly said right at the beginning, right? Your dad came from a school of thought of, hey, just get a job, right? Why do you need any? I remember my dad used to keep saying, don't be an American trying to find yourself, right? Just find a job. He used to use those words exactly, right? You're not an American who's trying to find yourself. So whenever I would have that impulse to, you know, take off or something, or even when I told him I'm leaving PNG to travel, I think his thing was that, look, you don't think you're an American who's trying to find himself? You don't have that luxury, right? That was the, but then we were the generation which was changing, because yeah. We did have that luxury to leave a job because it was not a government job that you couldn't find again, travel, come back, find a job again. And I think that we were the first generation, I guess, who was making those moves, right? And I think that's why the writing found a bit of a chord in India, because nobody was quite writing about stuff like that at that phase, at that time. And that's why it found a chord, because many people were asking the same question, that do we have to follow the path that was set for us when the world around us is changing much so significantly? Yeah.
So I want to back to the beginning of your career. You come out of school, business school in India, and you get a job with P&G in India. And over the course of the next 6 years, you follow the path, so to speak. You bounce around Southeast Asia, working on one of the biggest brands. You get that sweet expat assignment to come to the US and work on a very fast-growing brand that was in a relaunch. And like many people we've had on this podcast, there were a lot of early learnings from those days at P&G. Are there any stories or lessons that you learned in those, call it, formative career years of yours?
Yes, I would say tremendously. P&G, the most formative. I mean, I would say very, very fortunate to have had that opportunity. Really fortunate. I keep thanking the world often for that opportunity. I would say everything changed because of that. In some ways, I would say, I'll talk about the professional learning in a bit because those are very obvious. But I would say the personal learning was, I was very fortunate that right after business school, I was in India for a few months, but then I moved to Philippines, right? I was all alone in Philippines. Then I was all alone in Cincinnati, Ohio. Singapore also, we were in the early days when Singapore office was just being formed. I would say the early experiences of loneliness were very, very formative, because what happens is that when you're in your environment, right, even when we were in India, even in P&G, there was such a clutter of the same opinions that you've been with throughout, right, are all around you, right? So your friends from school, your friends from college. So you go to office, you come back, you meet the same people. And what happens is that your worldview remains pretty much the same. With P&G, I would say the best part was getting those experiences to be all alone in different countries. And I started to come into myself. I started to form my own views on who I am, what I want. And I think everything that happened afterwards was a consequence of that, right? The fact that, look, I do want to be the person who leaves my job to travel, because I've seen that dynamic in the US. And even if I didn't grow up like that, I can do that. I think it all happened because I was very lonely for long periods of time, personally, when I was moving with P&G, and I started to form that silence came around what I wanted versus what was the reflecting the opinions of everybody around me, which happens when you're not in a land distant from yourself. So I would say that's been the fortunate personal outcome, which I never planned for, obviously, when I joined P&G. Everything else that, obviously, when you join Procter & Gamble, I would say the biggest learning I received in a way was the very, I would say, the military-style leadership of P&G in some ways, where I remember so clearly, right off the gate, that you just took full ownership of everything, right? That was very critical to the P&G thing, that, you know, there's just this feeling of radical accountability, right? When you own the brand, you own it fully, right? And you are the person, the buck stops at you. I don't know, it's been so formative, and because we forget that doesn't happen actually in organizations often. And to have that experience in P&G, I think I always after that felt that the buck stopped at me every time, right? So even if I was writing a book, I felt like the buck stopped at me to market it, to publish it, to make it a bestseller. That feeling that the buck stops at you everywhere was a very Procter & Gamble feeling. And I think very fortunate to have that early.
Yeah, that ownership and accountability.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But back to the first thing you said, it's so interesting. There's a meditative practice of kind of silence. And that's a very scary thing for a lot of people, to be trapped with your own thoughts, to ask yourself the hard questions. So it sounds like in those career moves, bouncing around the world for P&G, while you were making friends, you were doing great work, you were kind of on your own, having to hit the reset button socially every time.
Correct.
So you were on your own with your thoughts about what am I doing with my career and with my life, multiple times over the course of 6 years.
Absolutely. Very, very true. Because in Philippines, for example, when I first moved with PNG, the weekends free, not knowing the language, not knowing anybody, I started to hike volcanoes and stuff, right? So I really picked up, because I hadn't hiked that much before. So because of that, I really picked up an enduring interest in hiking. And that became an enduring theme in my life. I did a lot of climbing and hiking after that. And all of that was very solitary. And I realized that, look, this is me. I like hiking and I like traveling. And I was like, okay, that's the path I'm going to be on. And as the clutter of company kind of kept falling away, I think I made more and more authentic choices. So I would say the most fortunate thing about PNG for everybody is the fact that you have such a global career right at the onset, which allows you to press the reset button, as you call it, or leave the frameworks that have guided your life all behind and kind of almost become very authentic to yourself because you are in a new place every so often. So, yeah.
So across your professional career or even your creative career, did anything ever not work out the way that you thought it would?
I would say every so often, so significantly at every point of time, right? I would say to give you a sense, right, the first or second novel I wrote, they were huge or significant bestsellers in India, right? Despite the fact that I wrote them, the first one kind of somewhat part-time with PNG, then a little bit while traveling, the second one also. But the third one, I spent 5 years full-time, out of which 2 years were full-time when I was in New York writing. And I was rejected 61 times, I remember exactly, 61
wow.
times before that novel was published, right? And then even after it was published, it was like it sold nothing at all. It sold way less than all the earlier books had sold, right? Despite the fact that it took 5 years of my life fully. I would say Discovery, when I became the CEO, I had a very major failure, right? I was called to reinvent Discovery in India. I did my best, obviously it didn't work. What I've learned is that significant creative endeavors have very small probability of success, right? And I think the best thing that a creator can do is to forget about the output and just focus on the input. Because in a way, the creative act is a slot machine where you don't know. You just play the slots with the same energy, and sometimes you're going to hit the jackpot and sometimes you're going to come broke and you don't know why, right? Because your input, in a sense, doesn't vary, right? You put the same energy. I put the same energy in kind of relaunching Discovery in India that I put in Whitehead Junior. One led to kind of abject failure. The other was a $300 million like exit in 18 months, right? Obviously, the input remained the same, right? So what happens, I think, in this creative endeavors is that the probability of success is low because the world doesn't need a new creation in that sense, right? It's not asking for it. And you just don't know whether you're going to hit the jackpot or go broke. And I think the only thing that a creator can do is to just play the slots, right? And I think that's what I've kind of somehow just ended up defining my life right now, that all I owe life is my gift of energy every day, full energy every day. And sometimes I'm going to hit the jackpot. Sometimes I'm going to come broke, and I should just focus on that input of giving my full energy every day. Yeah.
I mean, there's definitely a lot of perseverance in that act and in that approach, but are there lessons you learn through some of the failures that you take to the next one? As you mentioned, Discovery didn't work out the way you wanted it to. You didn't take the exact same approach to White Hat Junior, though, did you? Were there any things from the rejections of novel number 3, from the less than ideal outcome at Discovery that you took on to some of the other things along?
Yeah, very much. So I think obviously the best thing you'd do is to debrief on that whole failure. Obviously, failure is a celebrated thing in retrospect. Everybody talks about it. But when you're going through it, it is very, very hard, you know, obviously. So yeah. I remember in Discovery's time when I launched a very big TV channel, burnt a lot of money for the company because it did not succeed. It's very, you become a laughingstock, right, for the world at that period of time. It's very sad, right? You're going through a lot because you did your best, but it didn't succeed. It's so public a failure. Everybody's criticizing you, right? And it's very, what I've seen is that the failures become more and more public the higher and higher you go, right? So the first novel, the third novel failing, maybe few people knew. Discovery failing, a lot of people knew, right? Startup going down or negative press around a startup, everybody knows, right? So I think the failures keep increasing in scale. So in the Discovery experience, for example, I learned that the Procter & Gamble leadership style doesn't work in a startup, right? So it was a very clear learning for me, right? So Discovery, I ran like a PNG while I was almost building a startup there by starting a new TV channel from scratch. And
what about it didn't work?
So I would say the founder's role in a startup is very, it has to be very micromanagerial in some sense, not to use a negative word, but in a sense that the founder's attention to detail will rub off on the organization. And obviously in PNG, you are trained to be delegative, right? As you get higher and higher up and respect and trust people a lot, which you should obviously do in every capacity. But the founder's complete manic attention to detail will shape every part of the product flow. And startups are so volatile, for instance, that as we all know the principle, right, that your product should be 10x better than anything in the market in order to have even a chance at success. And the only way a product becomes 10x better is when your attention to detail percolates down the whole organization. So in a sense, with Discovery, when I was launching a new channel, you were trying to create a 10x better product than the 100 TV channels in the market. But I didn't have that level of micro attention to detail. And as a result, it didn't, I guess, show in the work, right, being beautiful. So I think in the Whitehead Junior case, I learned that, right, that I should build a product that is so. And then even within Whitehead Junior also, post-acquisition, there's been obviously a fair amount of negative press on Whitehead Junior on what it hasn't done well. And you learn from all of that. And right, and then I'm like, the next thing I'll do, I'm obviously going to learn from that. But yeah, very, very significant learnings from each failure, because it's so, at that point of time, it seems like such an end of the world when it happens. Yeah.
One of the first startups I went to, the founder and I were on a trip with major client, major brand, and we had the biggest win in the world. But as we're walking out of that office, the other founder called us and told us our top business partner was about to pull the plug on some of our core technology. So it's this, the lesson is kind of, it's not just in startups and being an entrepreneur, but life is a roller coaster. You will have the highest highs and the lowest lows. And the sooner you can calibrate yourself to not get too excited, still celebrate the win.
Correct.
But the better you can kind of take those like punches to the gut and to keep moving, to keep persevering, to take the good with the bad. It seems like an obvious lesson, but until you're in the arena and feeling those body blows or those amazing highs, you have to learn to ride the roller coaster.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Totally. Yeah. And I think the best learning for me was just go obsessive on the input, right? Very high energy on the input. And each day, think of it as a slot machine you're playing, right? You're very high, and all you owe the slot machine is your gift of energy, right? That just play it with full energy. And just don't get impacted too much and think of yourself as a star because you hit a jackpot, and don't think of yourself as a very big loser if you kind of hit broke, because it's the nature of the slot machine, right? Sometimes it will give you great output and sometimes it won't.
Well, to play the analogy out a little bit more, because you're not the typical business executive, Karan, even though your resume might read like it at a part, but you are an entrepreneur. And to play the metaphor of the slot machine out, there's a lot more gambling than just get the brand manager assignment, the marketing director assignment, right, the general manager assignment. So do you think there's something about entrepreneurs specifically that are willing to keep going back to the slot machine versus others?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. That's what I think. It's not about entrepreneurs per se. I think it's the act of creating something from really zero, right? The blank paper of a novel that turns into a 300-page novel or a book, for example, or the first day you go and obviously you need all the usual cliches of self-belief and all of that stuff, but you need to be excited about that idea that I'm going to take this blank page and turn it into a 300-page novel, and or I'm going to take this idea and truly turn it into a company. You need to you need to be excited enough and be able to visualize that outcome enough to just keep showing up and showing up and showing up every day. I would say more than an entrepreneur, even the novelist's life is actually tougher in some sense, because the novelist is only selling, like at least in the startup thing, what happens is that you build something, your team starts to grow, you can start to see traction, right? Even as it becomes into a big company that sells or it gets a crazy valuation. But like,
but as a novel, it's you and the keyboard.
Yeah, it's just you and the keyboard alone for, I remember like, when I was writing my third novel and my wife's parents were like, hey, isn't this the same novel that you were writing 1 year ago? And and they were being very nice. They were not.
Yeah. There are similarities, my friend.
Right. They were like, is this a different novel or is it the same novel that you were writing a year ago? And it's very hard to explain that. Look, for 1 year, I was just, I'm just with me and my keyboard. And then eventually after that, hoping that it turns into something that publishers will buy and the world will buy. So you need that real belief in the product that you're creating, that you persevere through that period. And I think that's what I would say. I would say that the whole 0-to-1 act has a lot of elements to it, right? That belief in that output, that kind of self-confidence to stick through this period where nobody can see that output apart from you, and it turns into something. And then the third, I think, is over a period of time, what actually happens is that, like when I started the startup, for example, I was very sure of one thing, that even if this doesn't work, it'll transform me, Right. I think that's very good learning. That happened to me very late.
The act of doing
is going to transform me. So I think that happened very late. I wish I had that feeling early. By the time I hit the startup, I was totally a little bit more in the sense I was just like that the worst that can happen is that I'm going to be transformed completely. Right. And I think that's the worst case scenario, which is a scenario that you should always pick. Right. And I had no qualms at all about leaving the job. Right. So Discovery CEO, very comfortable, very settled, great job. And a very high paying in India. And the fact was that I looked at it and I said that, look, 2 years more of doing the Discovery CEO versus 2 years of trying to build a tech company without knowing tech at all, I'm going to transform in that act of building a tech company, right? And I think that would be the worst thing that can happen out of this whole thing. So I was like, okay, that's a no-brainer choice. But I think that feeling that you're going to get transformed by this act of creation, even if it doesn't achieve conventional success, I would say entrepreneurs have that feeling. If they've done, like, built things before, right? They have that feeling that, look, I'm going to get transformed as an act of this.
It's cliche, but the journey is more important than the destination.
Yes,
that's the worst
yes,
that can happen, I learned. As you kind of describe your approach, I don't think you're an entrepreneur. I don't think you're a business leader. I think you're a creator, that you're willing to spend the time, to keep going back to that metaphor of the slot machine, in business, traditional business, you're pulling the slot machine frequently with every launch, with every initiative, et cetera.
Yeah.
But with that blank sheet of paper, the novel that you're working on for 5 years or 2 years on nights and weekends, or even a startup that you're slogging at, building from scratch, it is a much longer pull of the slot machine, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And that, again, I think you have to have the creator's mindset, not even the entrepreneur's mindset.
Correct. The 0 to 1, like truly creating something from zero, that mindset, which has this feeling that I can transform through this act of creation, then that's good enough. And then the persistence to see it through, kind of the crazy belief in your own confidence in your own self that you'll create an output that the world will value. Yeah, so I think all of that is like the creator's mindset overall.
And now a word from our sponsor. On today's show, we're talking to Vivek Sundar, COO of Swiggy, the leading food delivery service in India. Vivek, India is the world's largest market. How did you approach scaling such a complicated business in such a crazy market?
Well, crazy markets call for crazy solutions. India is the world's craziest market for this business, and I'll tell you why. Consumers have taste preferences that absolutely would be from different planets. You can take different parts of India, and there would be different countries when it comes to their culinary preferences. Roads and traffic is a nightmare, and we need to use technology to be able to solve all of this. So we believe that we've harnessed the power of good people, the power of technology, and the power of operations to solve this problem. We asked consumers to tell us which cities to go into. We asked consumers to tell us which restaurants to add. And in many cases, we asked college students to become the city CEOs and made them part of the journey to blitzscale. So when it took us 4 years to get to 10 cities, in the next 18 months, we added 550 cities.
And how is the solution that you're providing to Indians different from similar solutions we have in the US and Europe?
The solution that works in America is never going to work in India. Traffic is crazy. Roads are crazy. People drive like crazy. So when you're trying a Domino's-like promise with over 100,000 restaurants, which all have their own sweet way to do things, and making good that promise, it requires three things. Intense technology in every little part of the operation. It requires you to be able to deal with problems that you can't even foresee in a normal working world. And it requires a human system that is intense in the training and the measurement of it. And so essentially, we believe we understand the craziness of the consumers better than other people. We believe we understand how to use technology, and we believe we leverage the power of the people in a really good way. And that's how we make it work.
Now, you were telling me that there's actually a ton of Americans using the product. Can you explain that?
There's a lot of people who are sitting in America and their old parents are locked down and they're saying, Dad and Mom, you shouldn't leave the place. Stay in at home. You're vulnerable.
And they're in India.
Their parents are 10,000 kilometers away in India. They're not listening to their kids. So the kids are basically saying, I'm going to make sure now that Swiggy delivers food, but also delivers groceries, also delivers pharmacies, also delivers pretty much anything, that I'm going to sit in California and have it all delivered to their homes. So it's funny how many people are firing up their apps in San Jose and saying, I want my father to get his vitamins. So basically sending the guy to a local chemist and picking up vitamins and delivering it to their parents' home. That's happening now. A friend called me up and said, listen, it's my dad's birthday. How do I surprise him? I said, you downloaded the app, and 32 minutes later, Black Forest cake was on his father's door. His father literally couldn't believe it. He called him up and said, how do you do this? I want to do this as well.
Wow. That's amazing. It's making a real difference in people's lives. How big are you guys?
So being a single country app, to be in the list of one of the world's most downloaded and used apps in the world is something that makes us, a very young company, pretty proud. I don't think there would be an urban Indian who has not seen a yellow t-shirted Swiggy delivery boy in the last 6 months. We're talking 600 million people having noticed a Swiggy delivery boy on the streets. We have millions and millions of people ordering food every single day. But the important thing is how frequently people use us. I mean, if you take a typical e-commerce person, he's likely to open the app and use it maybe 10 times a year. But our power users often order 50 times a month. That's insane. When you take the number of millions of users and you multiply that by the fact that they're opening the app maybe 100 times a month and ordering it from 50 times a month. That kind of frequency and stickiness is just crazy. It puts a lot of pressure on us and a responsibility to deliver.
Wow. If people want to learn a little bit more about your business, how can they find out more about Swiggy?
Well, now you can just download the app. And if you have a friend, even if you don't have a father sitting in India, if you have a friend, just ship something nice to him. In COVID, it'll be a nice surprise. I think that's the best way to do it, because we have a website and we have a LinkedIn page, and there are some more boring ways of finding out. But I'd say just download the app and deliver some goodness and some sweets to your friend in India.
I love the enthusiasm and the work that you guys are doing for a really complicated problem and a really interesting solution. So Vivek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now back to our show.
So most people have not heard of what White Hat Junior does. And I don't think I want to spend too much time talking about that specifically, but more the motive.
Yeah.
So because the number alone, not just that there was a very successful acquisition and exit, but the window in which it happened was very short.
Yeah.
But here's the real question. A founder, successful entrepreneur that I know in the States told me when I was thinking about going to a startup, he said, I invest in a lot of companies and I see two kinds of founders, the kind who build something because it'd be cool to do it, and the kind who build something because they can't live in a world where that thing doesn't exist. Those are the ones that tend to be the most successful because the persistence and the perseverance to birth that thing in the world is there, not unlike a novel. My guess is you fall into that with White Hat Junior. It's ed tech. It's teaching kids the skills needed for the oncoming century. Can you talk about the motivations? How do you go from discovery networks to teaching kids to code? What was the motivation? What was that moment? What was the ideation that helped you lead to this very mission-driven idea?
Two things. One was that it was actually quite a surprisingly simple decision, right? So what happened is I was reading about, when I had my own kids, right? I was reading about
how old
early
are your kids
childhood
now?
Stuff. 7 and 5. So when I started the company, they were 4 and 2, right? So I used to read, I just read a lot, right? That's been a very enduring part of my life. I've read a lot. So
same.
Obviously, yeah. So when my kids were born, I was reading a lot about child development, etc. Part of it is I ran into something around coding, right? And I really like this idea that coding, I wasn't excited about the idea being that it's necessary for the future. That wasn't actually the driving force, right? I really like the idea that kids who code early, they start to treat the world like a playground, right? They realize that everything in this world is an object that's created by someone, and I can create it too, because I can use this code to build something.
Reality
something
is happens. Theirs to mold, yeah.
Reality is theirs to mold, right? And that shapes their life completely, because they start to believe that they're going to just build things in this world, right? Because that's the exciting thing about the world. That really spoke to me, right? Because as I told you right now, right, one enduring regret of my life was that, look, why did I build my first thing at age 29? My life before that was very dry in retrospect, right? So I always felt that like my kids should build things early. So I was really, when I read about it, it just hit me like a lightning bolt that kids should build things early, right? And that's what will make them builders for life. And that's the best gift I can give my own kids. So that led to the idea behind White Hat Junior. So I think it was never about coding as a skill for the future. We marketed it like that probably, and maybe we over-marketed like that. But I would say it was always about kids building and creating things. And I think that really spoke to me, because it was a personal quest, a personal regret, something that I wanted for my own kids. And that's why I was like, yeah, this is something I should just plunge and do it. But for me, I think the good part was that because I lived through these periods before of making a decision that, look, I'm going to learn yoga for a year, then going through that heart-wrenching period of, should I leave my job to learn yoga? That seems like a foolish pursuit, right? Going through that opinion of family telling me that, look, you're not an American to learn yoga and all that. So, you know, I lived through that cycle so many times that this time I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I started building a prototype immediately. I remember the idea came to me in August. In September, I kind of built a prototype. In October, I told Discovery I was leaving. And I kind of raised funding, right, in November. And within a couple of years, I was like, you know, I built it and scaled it very fast. So I think that act of having done this multiple times before made me a little bit very comfortable with, okay, I'm just going to do it. It's a good idea. Yeah. That would have probably, otherwise for a typical person, I'm sure they have ideas like that. But if they've not done it, if they're doing it for the first time, then that period of idea to execution takes a long time to convince yourself that you're going to jump and take the plunge. For me, it just happened overnight. I was like, okay, look, I'm going to do this.
The startup founder's journey is a hard one. And it sometimes doesn't end in an exit in 18 months. But even those early months are hard. Some are solitary. Because to your point of you might have built a team, but you need to get into everything.
Correct.
What were some of the tough lessons? What were some of the tough decisions that you had to face in those first 18 months?
First 18 months is a long period. I would say the first 6 months are the hardest because once you have a model, business model, then people like us who come from Procter & Gamble or something, right? Once you have a business model, then you can start building a framework to scale it. I think the hardest thing is just that daily panic of, will I find a business model before I run out of money, right? And I think that panic is very real, right? So you have, when I raised $1.3 million and I had the framework of what I could build and I'd build something with early traction, but you're just kind of in that state of panic because you don't know whether you have a business model which will work enough to be able to, before you run out of money of experimenting, right? So in that period of time, you are kind of, so that's one part, right? That panic. And the second thing is that I think the worst part about a startup, I think in some ways, is that everything has to work, which I think has been one of the hardest learnings for me, that for a startup to succeed, you need to have a good product, a really, really good product, which is 10 times better than anything in the market. You need to build a great founding team. You need to be able to commercialize the product very well. You need to have great renewal rates. You need to have the product team, a tech team, a business team. Everything has to work very well. And there's no margin of failure at all in that. And I think that's probably the toughest period for me. Like, I think the first part was this whole feeling that, look, how do I make a business? Especially because it was creating a new category. Coding for kids, is it? First, people's reaction was that it's going to be too small, too niche. And I had to build that category from scratch in India or anywhere in the world, for example. It's like not an established category.
Mm. I want to shift gears a little bit. The world is, so many people in our audience are diverse professionals from all backgrounds, all countries, different ethnicities, different religions. And the world is, while it is increasingly diverse, there's still a lot of adversity out there. Throughout your career, what has been your take, your observation, as someone who sometimes sits in the majority, but then also sometimes sits in the minority? How do you thread that needle professionally? And what have you seen working and not working along the way?
It's a good time to reflect on this overall. I think my kind of just a general conclusion is that you have to, I guess, in some form or the other, truly work for people, or you'll be very fortunate to work for people who genuinely their heart believe in diversity, right? Like, I think there is a bit of a difference in that sense, right? I think we all believe in meritocracy, right? Every seasoned leader in every form will believe in meritocracy, right? Like, the act of truly believing in diversity is a function of your life experiences, etc., which I think we are very fortunate to get the PNG thing, right? Because in PNG, it was not lip service, right? I think people genuinely believe that having a diverse viewpoint on the table because of somebody's unique experience of gender or ethnicity will make the product better. And I think we were very fortunate to have that because it was truly global company that way, PNG, right? And I think that what's happened, I think now, right now, is that I don't need to look at any statistic around what percent of my leaders are women or really diverse, right? I just know very deeply in my heart that they'll just make to have a diverse leadership team or a diverse team at every level is just going to make everything better because empathy will come in, emotions will come in, which we won't be able to do without. And I think that is my kind of somehow learning is that, I guess the learning is that I think we should just choose people if we can to work with who in their heart really believe in it, right? And I think that reflects in their choices versus on any metric or of any kind, right? So I think anybody who came from PNG, we are very fortunate that I think we all believed in it a lot. We truly believe that it made things better. A diverse world made things better. Yeah.
Wouldn't you, at bigger companies, while there, it's like moving, for some big companies, there's more inertia to get past. But you have the luxury of an HR team and a diverse recruiting team. And, you know, you're global and you can bring in a guy from India or a girl from Venezuela, yeah, et cetera. But at startups, it's sometimes harder because, to your point of, you're so focused on the day-to-day management.
Yeah,
surviving. What advice would you give to entrepreneurs who don't have as much of the privilege and luxuries at their back that multinationals do to kind of attack this diversity angle?
You know, that's what I said. So the entrepreneur of any is actually very better suited that way, right? Because if the entrepreneur truly believes in diversity, their whole choices are shaped by that, right? So for me, very early on, I don't know, it was very formative to the company, right? For example, the Invited Junior, it's women teachers, right? It was very central to the model itself, right? Because here is what happened, right? My mother was an army officer's wife, right? She kept traveling with my dad every 2 years. Very talented lady. She was a topper in Delhi University. She could never have a career in her life, right? And I felt that there were thousands of women like this in India who are extremely educated, extremely qualified, who don't have a voice in the workforce. That's reflected in the data. 50% of college participants are women, but in the workforce, only 23% are women in India. So I built it very centrally to the business model that they should be, that we'll take women teachers, right? And we'll have a one-on-one teacher because there's a huge talent pool in India that can be leveraged. And we created a model around that, right? So it was very, you end up making business model choices out of diversity if you truly believe in it and you've understood it deeply. So my only advice to entrepreneurs is to read enough, widely enough, and truly believe, because it will really change your every part of the decision or the fabric that you make at the company.
So it's interesting that you mention the spouses of accomplished career people. I want to ask a little bit about your personal life.
Yeah.
The broader question is about the myth of balance, which it's a trick question. I think everyone has to find it. And it is, how have you found that as a husband and a father, building companies, taking time off to write, et cetera. But how do you, not just how do you balance your own work and life, but how do you balance your career against your spouse's career and what her aspirations are?
We found our way. I think my wife is a writer and nutritionist, and she's kept her career flourishing after kids and stuff. So I don't know if there's an easy answer. I think every couple and every person will find their own decisions. I'm trying to think if there is a single thought here which has guided us, but I would say, no, I don't have a single rule. I mean, I would just say that my spouse kind of built her career along with. I think the only thing I would say is that it goes in waves, and I think it should be okay. The waves are okay, right? It's not never going to be perfect, right? It'll go in waves, right? For example, in the startup phase, we were both very aligned that I would be very consumed by it. And I think in her book launched wave, even though I was running a startup, we were very aligned that she would be fully consumed by it. So I think as long as you're okay with the waves versus a single guiding framework, I think that ends up working out well. So we've oscillated in waves very deeply, where we've been very consumed by our individual things and the other steps up during that period.
Just make sure the kids have their floaties on as you guys are surfing.
Correct, exactly. Yeah.
I guess another way to frame it, though, we're now professionals managing a lot of other young professionals entering similar life stages, finding their partner, wanting to see the world, starting families. How do you coach the people in your organization to ride these waves?
See, startups are a bit different, right? So I would say my view of startups is that it's your very unique chance to compress 20 years of work into 4 years of work, which means that you can do 20 years of low intensity work or medium intensity work, or you could choose 4 years of very, very high intensity work. And you can, if things go right in those 4 years, you'll be rewarded in terms of personal growth, professional growth.
Yeah.
Which could be equivalent to 10 to 20 years in the regular. It's like dog years, right? So in the dog years, you can't question working hard. So because it's a bit of a choice that you make with the startup, right? Yeah. You trade off stability and work-life balance and all the usual things for a concentrated period of completely manic intense work. And you get outcomes accordingly, right? So the guys who joined me, for example, there's a guy who was in India, who I'm very proud of, right? He was sleeping on a railway station, right? Because he couldn't find a job for a few months, right? He came in and joined me as a call center executive in the startup because we were like 4 or 5 people and we were looking for the first call center executive. And he came and was, and he did so well. He got promoted to call center leader, then sales manager, then sales leader, and he became a vice president. That journey would have taken him maybe business school and 20 years in a conventional role, but we kind of grew so exponentially and he was so good that he, in 18 months, he went from sleeping on a railway station to becoming a vice president, which typically a business school, like a top business school graduate would be getting. So I think startups are a bit different, where you just trade off, it's dog years, right? And you just have to sign up for that.
In your career, who have been your mentors? And more importantly, how have you modeled their behavior in your career?
Oh, I would say the most enduring mentors are still from P&G. You know, I would say Shailesh Jejurikar, the guy who hired me in Procter & Gamble, really molded a lot of my views about life. I think there's a leader called JP Coolvine from Procter & Gamble who, I think for the first time, showed me a very boundaryless world. He was from Germany, lived in the US, came to Singapore as an expat. He showed us what the world could be, right? Where you could start from anywhere, come anywhere. So I think really, really formative. Within Singapore, these guys kind of pushed me to go to Cincinnati. I would say very, very formative seeing them in action. In Shailesh, his authenticity in leadership, right? He's so himself that gave us the confidence that you could just be yourself, right? And as a leader. So hugely, like, I think the mentors have been, I would say, P&G leaders, and then a lot of books have been mentors in many ways. Yeah.
What are some of those books that have been mentors?
Oh, a lot. I would say some enduring ones: Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, which is about, it's a Nazi concentration camp survivor, and he does a wonderful job figuring out that when everything was so gone, right, in the Nazi concentration camp, then they had nothing. They were lying naked in the snow, right? Some of them had the will to live, and the others, obviously 99%, didn't have the will to live. And what distinguished the people who had the will to live, right, and was meaning, and that real sense of meaning in their, like, very similar to in a startup in some senses, that you really need to believe that at the end of all this darkness, in that darkness, you're really, that meaning is driving you, you know, towards that end of the tunnel very hard. So I think there are books like that, right? Man's Search for Meaning has been very formative. And then I would actually say, surprisingly enough, fiction has been very meaningful. People haven't read the Forrest Gump novel, but I was very influenced by the Forrest Gump novel. Even before the movie came, I was lucky to read that. And that idea of, like, a completely boundaryless world really shaped my life, actually, in many ways, right? That of doing multiple things, living multiple places, just feeling that there was no boundaries to life. Surprisingly, I got it from a book like Forrest Gump. So I just read so much fiction, nonfiction. I just gave you two examples of books that have really stood, I know, have formed me a lot.
So Karan, it goes without saying that we've been going through some particularly crazy and challenging times around the world, beyond the pandemic, reckonings on race, a changing climate, etc. As a purpose-driven leader, someone who has led large and small organizations to success, what advice would you give to our leaders at the political, at the company, at the country level? Yeah, what advice would you give to our leaders to kind of face the challenges that we have ahead of us?
Interesting. It's a huge question.
Because they're all listening to this podcast, clearly.
Right. I mean, I would say the unit of change is the individual in some ways, right? See, there's a beautiful book called Leadership and Self-Deception, right? Which is where we can never deceive our people in a way. Whatever you're feeling in the inside is what's going to show in the outside as a leader. So I would say the very simple leadership and self-deception kind of principle, which is a good leader just becomes better and better, transforms himself or herself. And I think as a result will transform the world that they lead. And if you're, I think the biggest gift you can give to your organization is just self-improvement for yourself. And I think that should never end, right? The act of reading, learning, just that kind of driving quest to become a better version of yourself will lead to a driving quest for the organization to become a better version of itself. So I think the unit of change is the individual. And I think the individual's personal crisis and its individual's personal trials are reflected in at a very large scale. And that's what happens as a leadership, right? So,
great.
Yeah.
So Karan, we've got to wrap up soon. So I want to ask a few fun questions. What is something about you? There's so much about you, but what is something maybe that we haven't covered that surprises people?
Yeah, I would say surprises people in the sense, kind of my idea for vacation is to do a very, very, to do very hard things. You know, I think that's what energizes me the most. So in a way, I would, anytime I choose a vacation, I would choose like a 10-day silent retreat or something like a Vipassana retreat or climbing Kilimanjaro. Or I would say tough things really are very transformative for the soul. And my vacation looks like a very rigorous is not the right word, but I would say, yeah, that would be a bit surprising, right? My vacation would look much, much tougher than my regular life, if you will. And that truly transforms me. It's just a small quirk that I remembered as you asked me.
I think I know the answer to this, but what is your go-to media escape? Movies, books, or TV?
Books, but also I would say I watch a fair amount of movies.
And since we have talked a lot about books already, what is a movie that has characters that you relate to?
There is a Korean movie called Old Boy, which has been, I don't know, not too many people have seen it, but there's a Hollywood.
Yeah.
Surprisingly enough, I would say I was very inspired, although I'm sure nobody meant it to be an inspirational movie, but I like the idea of hitting such a rock bottom. I couldn't think of anything and the will to climb out of it. So I would say Old Boy and Cinema Paradiso, which is a lovely Italian film, which in its beautiful way talks about what truly means, in a very wonderful way talks about what the true meaning of life is and what really matters in life. Yeah.
Both are fantastic films. I love the fact that you did not pick an American or an Indian movie. So,
Apocalypse Now, I would say. Maybe the third one would be Apocalypse. That's all. Apocalypse Now is, I would say, such a triumph of imagination and creativity. I think whenever I see a movie like that, I just feel, I think this is what human condition is, right? To strive for such a work of art is beautiful, you know.
Who is someone out there that you would still want to get coffee with?
Oh, interesting. Someone out there who I would still love to get coffee with. I don't know. Somebody who's kind of built themselves from destruction, I think, is always very inspiring to meet. I'm just trying to think, there are kind of multiple folks like that. The usual ones, like an Elon Musk or somebody. How do they manage all that? How do they, like, I don't know, how do they have that will to keep building from scratch again and again would be very powerful. I would love to have that in my life.
Especially when the odds are stacked against them.
So, the odds are stacked against you, yeah. What kind of gives you that kind of complete resilience to keep climbing out of it?
Someone once told me it's kind of like a slot machine, Karan.
Right, exactly.
So Karan, what is one final piece of advice or even a challenge that you would give to the next generation?
My only advice is to build things early. That's the only advice I would give, which is to build something early, create something very early, a 0-to-1 thing early. Could be a novel, could be a short story, could be a movie. Dabble with something that you are building from scratch early, and I think it'll transform your life.
Karan, that's great advice. And it has been, we catch up every few years when we run into each other at a museum or on a train or something. And I'm glad to see you succeeding so much, not just in work, but in life. And I can't wait to see the next thing that you create. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Raman. Always a delight to speak to you.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the PNG Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former PNGers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
Now here's a preview of next week's episode.
My experience is that when you're the only one or just a few female at the table, it's tougher for our voice to be listened to fully for what our thinking entails. Imagine this room with multiple baritones and there's only one soprano. And so many times this soprano voice is being interrupted while she's speaking, and her ideas are good, the arguments are valid, but a few are not really listening because unconsciously my voice or a woman's voice tends to be heard by senior men more like their wife's or their daughter's voice and not like their professional colleague or their peer. And this is a very hard obstacle to overcome because it's unconscious even for deep allies of gender equality.
That's it for this week. I've been Roman Segal.
And I'm still Andrew Tarvin. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the PNG Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.